Thanks for tuning in for the June 1st podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals, Neurology, Neurology Genetics, Neurology, Neuroimmunology and Inflammation, and Neurology Clinical Practice. For our What's Trending segment, you'll hear from Professor Antonio Belli on the role of salivary small non-coding RNAs on the diagnosis of sports-related concussion. This week's feature interview is with Dr. Linda D'Antona, and it focuses on the utility of brain MRI and ophthalmic biomarkers for the prediction of intracranial hypertension.
Hi, this is Alex Menzi. I'm with the Permanente Medical Group in Sacramento, California. Today, I'm interviewing Antonio Belli from the University of Birmingham Institute of Inflammation and Aging in the United Kingdom. We're going to discuss a paper published online in the British Journal of Sports Medicine titled Unique Diagnostic Signatures of Concussion in the Saliva of Male Athletes, the Study of Concussion in Rugby Union Through MicroRNAs, Scrum. Good afternoon, Tony. Thanks for joining us today.
Yeah, good afternoon, Alex. Thank you for inviting me.
Absolutely. You have some very exciting results to discuss from this study regarding concussion evaluations. Can you briefly tell us the main results of your paper?
Well, what the paper shows is that we can identify markers of concussion in saliva, obviously in a non-invasive way, you know, from athletes. And what is actually exciting about the results, at least from my point of view, is actually that now we know that these biomarkers are present from the word go. So really, they're identifiable almost immediately after the event.
Could you explain to us what microRNA biomarkers are and how they are related to concussion?
Effectively, microRNAs, or sort of, you know, perhaps in the broader term, you know, small non-coding RNAs are messengers that travel between cells. So whenever there is an event, you know, for disease or sort of physiological event, the cells communicate with one another by exchanging messages in a number of different ways. And this is perhaps one of the more recently discovered ways of communicating between cells, which is by effectively exchanging bits of genetic material, so RNA material, that what it does is just switch genes off or on in a way that is helpful for other tissues to program the response to an event, in this case, injury. So what SNC RNAs, small non-coding RNAs do and microRNAs do is really to effectively to program other cells to respond to an event, in this case, a concussion.
Okay, if you could go into a little more detail with your results then. Which of these microRNA biomarkers changed after concussion, and when did they change, and how long did they remain abnormal?
The biomarkers that change after a concussive event are related to a number of different mechanisms that, for example, correlate with metabolism, so switching to fatty acid nutrition, for example, rather than glucose metabolism. There are some of these biomarkers correlate with neurodegenerative conditions or mental health disorders, from just looking at the pathways that sort of the microRNAs activate or disable. And the majority of these correlate with just in generic terms with inflammation, so particularly neuroinflammation, but inflammation in general. The interesting thing about these microRNAs, these are not byproducts of cell damage, for example, like protein biomarkers. They effectively, what they do, they program a response to injury, and therefore we think looking at the spectrum of response in saliva, it could be that these biomarkers effectively are there to activate and program the best possible response to injury. In previous research, we worked out that some of the microRNAs that are expressed after severe traumatic brain injury are different from what is expressed after mild traumatic brain injury. So many of these are in common to see brain trauma in general, but some of these only really are seen in severe or mild traumatic brain injury. And this is possibly because the body response to injury needs to be different if you have a severe or a mild event.
Well, I think one of the things that we should go into a little detail about is the methods that you used in determining whether or not your study subjects had had a concussion. So if you could go over a little bit of how you ran the study with regard to determining the players that had concussion and then how you sampled their saliva, I think that would help the audience understand exactly how interesting this study is.
So it's a tool that's used in rugby and many other sports where the player is after a sort of suspected event, is subjected to a number of rapid tests, including a neurological examination, a memory recall test, and, you know, balance assessment and so forth, and a list of symptoms. And also what is interesting about doing the study in rugby, we're able to use video replays to validate whether an injury was likely to have occurred or not. So what we use is effectively as a reference was the World Rugby Protocol for diagnosing concussion, which is thought to be about sort of, you know, 90-95% accurate. So obviously some events are missed even with video replays. And that was our reference. Obviously we can't do really much better than the reference in any study, but we think the references it was actually good enough in the absence of any other, you know, objective way of diagnosing concussion. So what we did in the study was to take saliva samples from players at the beginning of the season, so baseline samples before any injury could have occurred. And then when a player was removed to be assessed for a potential injury, we took a saliva sample from that player. We also took samples from control players, for example, players that had a musculoskeletal injury, so they had to abandon the game because of an ankle injury or a knee injury. And we also used players that had competed in the same match but has suffered no adverse event at all. This we call these uninjured controls. So in the study, we had effectively players that were clearly concussed following the sort of the head injury assessment using the video replays. We also had players that, you know, had gone through the head injury assessment but were deemed not to be concussed. And then we had the two control groups of musculoskeletal injuries and the players that sort of simply played in the match but has suffered no adverse events. So the study really was about comparing all these groups to see whether there was something that was unique to the concussed group of players.
So you obtained a baseline saliva sample at the beginning of the match or the beginning of the season, and then you utilize that baseline to compare the change in these microRNA biomarkers. Do you feel like you need to have the baseline sample in order to interpret the results of this test? Or is this something that can be used on anyone at any time and you'd be able to approximately assess that they had or did not have a concussion?
If you don't have the baseline sample, the accuracy drops a bit, but probably about 2-3 percentage points. So it's something that perhaps in a way, you know, if you don't have a baseline value for those biomarkers, it's something you can probably live with. The accuracy of our test in our results was about 94%. So it's actually was pretty good. If you don't have a baseline, it drops to about sort of 90-91%.
Well, that's pretty fantastic for community sports because obviously they're probably not going to have the ability to get a sample on every single player, particularly at the younger ages. So do you feel like we can extrapolate these results to females or to children at this point? Or do you feel like more research needs to be done for that?
I think that more research needs to be done. And I think we know there are differences between male and female concussion, for example. So I wouldn't really want to extrapolate to female athletes or certainly younger athletes. And I think this is a piece of research that still needs to be done.
So you had a pretty good understanding, or it seems that you did, of the types of microRNA messaging biomarkers that were involved with concussion based on former research. When you were doing this study, was there anything that surprised you while you were getting the results and examining the results from Scrum?
I think what surprised me in particular was how quickly these biomarkers appear in saliva. This is something that I wouldn't say I wasn't expecting, but it went beyond my expectations to some degree.
Well, that's extraordinary, really. I mean, because that's what you want in your players is you want to be able to say, hey, you had a concussion. And it really depends on how quickly you can get those sample results back to determine whether or not you can get a player back onto the pitch or onto the field. That's pretty incredible. Tony, do you think we're going to see sideline test kits for this in the sports world soon?
Well, I hope that we will see sideline kits in sports and probably military and maybe in our healthcare applications soon. I think what we've actually seen in the last year is a major sort of, you know, advance in this kind of technology. You know, this is effectively used as the same technology as is used for COVID, for coronavirus. But I'm quietly confident we're going to get there because simply because the technologies are advancing so quickly, and work needs to be done in this regard. But it certainly seems possible to be able to provide some feedback to the sideline medics and within useful timescales. I think is not too futuristic right now.
So now we have technology that could potentially evaluate a player within minutes of concussion with some microRNA messenger biomarkers. Thank you so much for your time today, Tony, and for sharing your expertise with us. I've been speaking with Antonio Belli about his paper titled Unique Diagnostic Signatures of Concussion in the Saliva of Male Athletes, the Study of Concussion in Rugby Union Through MicroRNAs, or SCRUM. Thanks, Tony.
Thank you very much.
Hi, this is David Lapidus with the University of Virginia. Today, I'm joined by Linda D'Antona. She's a neurosurgery trainee at Queen's Square Hospital in London. She's joining us today to talk about her and her group's paper, Brain MRI and Ophthalmic Biomarkers of Intracranial Pressure, published this week in Neurology. Thank you so much for joining us, Linda.
Thank you so much for your kind invitation.
Of course. So I want to get into the paper and discuss the exciting results that may suggest some changes in the way that we diagnose increased intracranial pressure. But can you start by telling us about the current standard of ICP diagnosis?
Yes, of course. At the moment, there are three main methods for measuring intracranial pressure. The most common and widely used is lumbar punctures. And then there are specific centers that focus on different types of techniques, including lumbar infusion studies and intracranial pressure monitoring. Of course, we are mainly talking of non-emergency settings, so patients who have suspected CSF dynamics abnormalities, but not patients with traumatic brain injury.
Okay, so those are all invasive techniques, and I know that that's specifically what we're getting into. So to understand the motivation behind this study, can you tell us about the limitations of the current standard of practice for diagnosing increased intracranial pressure?
So the gold standard at the moment is lumbar punctures, as we said, and lumbar punctures have two main limitations. One is the fact that the measurements taken during lumbar punctures are highly dependent on the patient position. And in fact, even slight changes on the neck position or how much they're bending their knees during lateral decubitus position can change the opening pressure. And of course, even sitting versus lateral decubitus position changes massively the pressure that you get. So they can sometimes be unreliable, especially when the pressure is on the borderline side of things. And the other very important limitation is that our intracranial pressure changes all the time physiologically with the heartbeat, with the respiration, with the movement, with the body position. So lumbar punctures only offer one of snapshot measurements of what is actually a very dynamic figure.
Great. That's really helpful to review, especially since so frequently we're confronted with issues of, is 30 millimeters of mercury elevated in this patient with this BMI, et cetera. And the fact that it's so dynamic certainly means that it's less than ultimately reliable. So your group looked at non-invasive biomarkers, MRI findings and ophthalmologic findings. And ultimately, were these biomarkers useful at predicting who had elevated intracranial pressure?
So absolutely. We are trying to, of course, to move as far away as we can from invasive techniques. And we looked at four brain imaging, in particular on MRI biomarkers and two ophthalmic biomarkers. And what we found is that all the biomarkers we looked at had a very good association with intracranial pressure. However, each of them, especially the brain MRI biomarkers, can give false positives and false negatives when looked in an isolated way. And our paper shows the strength of using all of these widely available biomarkers, which are non-invasive and simple to detect, and putting them together is the strength of this non-invasive assessment system. In particular, we realized that patients who don't have any abnormal biomarker are extremely unlikely to have a significantly high intracranial pressure. And on the other side, we found that patients who have multiple biomarkers, in particular, at least three, and especially when one at least is an ophthalmic biomarker, are extremely likely to have high intracranial pressure. And that changes practice because it gives us an idea of how fast we need to treat the patient and manage the patient.
And without going into the full history of how the biomarkers were chosen, can you tell us what each of the MRI and ophthalmologic finding biomarkers are?
Yes. So we looked at very well-known brain imaging biomarkers. In particular, on brain MRI, we looked at the shape of the pituitary gland, and in particular at empty cella. We looked at the vertical tortuosity of the optic nerves, at the distension of the optic nerve sheath, and at the protrusion of the optic nerve head at the level of the globes. And in regards to the ophthalmic biomarkers, we looked at papilledema in a traditional way through fundoscopy, and we looked at absence of spontaneous venous pulsation. For this assessment, we find that simple fundoscopy is often not very reliable, so we used recordings done with OCT machine, which is widely available in ophthalmology clinics. And we had independent assessor for each of the biomarkers, so two assessors for each of them.
Okay, great. And since these biomarkers are relatively easy to evaluate, in, even in the clinic setting or in imaging setting, especially in comparison to monitoring with an intracranial bolt, how are you recommending that we use this data to change our workup of patients with IIH or other disorders of elevated ICP? And then accordingly, what patient populations is this going to specifically apply to as we're dealing with non-emergent elevated ICP?
So our study is a mixed bag of patients with different diagnoses. Of course, this is especially useful for patients with IIH, but we find that, for example, sometimes patients with Chiari malformation type 1 can have raised intracranial pressure, and in occasion, this can be helpful for them as well. And of course, patients with hydrocephalus and patients with shunts, when you suspect shunt malfunctioning, that's not obvious on a simple CT scan.
So how is this changing your practice? Are you not doing lumbar punctures at the same rate to make this diagnosis? Are you feeling comfortable with these biomarkers instead to make this evaluation and diagnosis?
I have to say that Queen Square is a bit of a different environment. We do get referrals for patients who are normally quite complex, and we tend to not do lumbar punctures as often as other centers, especially in view of the previously discussed limitations. However, for the management of IIH in particular, I would like to mention that we do have national guidelines that include lumbar punctures. So they're still being performed, but normally not in our center, just before they're referred. These biomarkers, however, have changed our practice significantly, because now, for example, we know that patients who don't have any of the biomarkers then are extremely unlikely to have significantly raised intracranial pressure. So these are the patients who don't get ICP monitoring, and these are the patients who are just monitored over time clinically. Of course, they are always followed up, but they don't get ICP monitoring. And on the other side, when someone presents with a very strong clinical picture of raised intracranial pressure and has three or more of the biomarkers, especially when one of them is an ophthalmic sign of raised ICP, then they don't need ICP monitoring, and we have started treating them straight away. And it's also very useful because this gives you a system to understand how quickly you need to treat that patient to protect their vision. So it's also very helpful.
Great. So these are really biomarkers that are available outside of these tertiary care centers that are accessible to anybody. And so we can essentially, maybe as the updates in diagnostic criteria change, we'll have a set of checkboxes where we can say this patient has three of the biomarkers and therefore they very likely have elevated ICP and we should move forward with testing and or treatment, or they only have one and therefore the diagnosis is much less likely. We should feel comfortable monitoring going forward. Does that sound fair?
Yes, exactly.
Wonderful. Well, Linda, this has been really helpful. I certainly encourage our audience to take a look through this paper. It's very easily digestible and, again, can be easily and quickly incorporated into clinical practice. So, Linda, thank you so much for joining us today to discuss your paper, Brain MRI and Ophthalmic Biomarkers of Intracranial Pressure, published in this week's Neurology.
Thank you very much.
This is Jose Merino. Please check out this week's journal, which features an article that investigates heterogeneity in disease progression, influences the detection of treatment effects in Alzheimer's disease clinical trials, as well as a study determining the association between electroencephalographic seizures and an unfavorable neurobehavioral outcome in critically ill children. Please take a look at this and other articles in this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.